94 WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. It's not every day that I get to say that I am speaking with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. I am really honored, deeply honored, to be speaking today with Greg Miller, who is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. And he shared the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for his investigative reporting. And much of that reporting lies at the heart of an extraordinary new book, an important new book, called The Apprentice: Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. This is a very thorough book that explores the connections between President Trump and those closest to him, and Russia and Vladimir Putin. And it is a book that explores these possibilities thoroughly and aggressively, and yet without talking about things that aren't in fact there. I mean, in other words, it is a meticulously researched book. It is carefully written, although also in a sense aggressively written, in the sense of not shying away from some truly disturbing possibilities. And the book is published by Custom House, and I'm very, very grateful for this opportunity to speak with its author, Greg Miller. Greg Miller, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, and thank you for the very warm introduction.
I only feel bad about the last part. What I was trying to say, and I don't think I said it as deftly as I wanted to, is that I am impressed by how this book has a quality of caution. And at the same time, it is a book that's full of explosive information. Sometimes books that are full of explosive information are carelessly written for the sake of gaining headlines and gaining readership and so on. And my sense of this book is that it is both of those things, explosive in its content and yet meticulous in a sense of its caution and well-reasoned approach. I assume that was very important to you. I wonder if you could just talk about the weighing of those two factors in putting together a book like this.
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. I'm glad that you raised that. And you're right. I mean, I did try to take great care in this book to hew to the facts and to not shy away from or hesitate to describe them in you use the word aggressive, in an aggressive way. But at the same time, you know, we're in such a polarized moment in our country, such a hyper-partisan moment. And I want readers to sort of trust the content here. I want them to read this account of what happened in 2016 and the aftermath. This book does carry us deep into the Trump presidency and his relationship with Vladimir Putin. And I want them to trust the content and not dismiss it or be skeptical of it because they see the language as overheated. I mean, there's also a much more sort of mundane consideration on my end, which is I'm a reporter. I'm still working. I'm at the Washington Post. I cover the Trump administration and national security issues. And, you know, the Post, of course, has a very high standard of objectivity and fairness. And so, I mean, this book can't be inconsistent with those values because of where I work and who I am and who my bosses are.
I would like to ask you a question about your sources. And I want to confess that part of what prompts this is the fascinating conversation that you had with Terry Gross on Fresh Air. And I'm trying to be careful not to replow exactly the same ground or to ask any of the exact questions that she asked, although it's tempting, but also in a sense pointless. That interview is widely available, and I hope our morning show listeners will take advantage, if they haven't already, to listen to that fascinating and illuminating conversation. You spent some time with Terry Gross talking about your sources, and in many cases they are anonymous sources, and just trying to clarify the point that although they are anonymous to the general public and to the reader, they are not anonymous to you. These are people that you know, and I mean, you know who they are, and you know from what sort of position they speak. I wonder if you could just explain, in a sense, the matrix involved in terms of trustworthiness and the relative value of various sources, and especially sources that choose to remain anonymous. Which sources are most valuable to you, and how do you kind of sort out to what source to turn to get a particular question answered?
That's interesting. So I think I would say that, you know, sources are valuable to reporters on kind of in two directions. One is their access to information, their possession of information that we think is important, that we're trying to get at. And then there's another axis here, and that is kind of a trusting relationship with sources. And difficult stories, complex stories often require finding an intersection of these two kinds of sources. So you're seeking out new people who have information that you need. You want to understand something that's happening inside the White House or at the State Department or the CIA. And there's sort of a set group of people who might have insight into that. So you're trying to get them, and you may not have any existing relationship with those people. You might be knocking on their doors at night, and half of them might slam the door in your face. But maybe one will linger for a moment and answer a couple questions. But you can't really get very far without also having a set of sort of long-standing, deeply knowledgeable sources about how things work, even if they don't have the sort of more current information you're looking for. They're people that you've known for a long time, who've worked at the CIA or at the White House or at the State Department or at the Pentagon. They know how those buildings work. They know how government works. You can talk to them about what you're reporting. And because you've known them for many years, there's a sort of level of trust there. You can trust that they are going to help you process what you're hearing from other sources. So it's basically sort of gathering material from new sources, but often checking it with long-standing sources.
I should think one special challenge that you face in this current political situation and political environment is that there are so many people in Washington, in a sense on the inside, who feel such a high level of consternation about the turn that our government has taken. I mean, that feel real dismay and sometimes profound fear about what is going on, about the way the country is led, about our current president and those closest to him. And I should think that one challenge for you is to sort of figure out then when somebody on the inside with these kind of deep concerns is talking to you, how much of what they are sharing with you is springing out of that very emotional, sort of visceral place versus a sharing with you of the cold, hard facts, which cannot be disputed. Can you just talk for a moment about what you need to do as a reporter in terms of sort of ferreting out which is which when you are hearing from a source?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and that's part of every reporter's job, and it's an important skill that takes time to sort of acquire. You know, I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding sometimes about reporters and the sources they rely on and their motivations. I mean, we turn to sources with all kinds of motivations, and they're not always good motivations. That doesn't necessarily mean the information they have is bad. I mean, it's always important to consider a source's motivation and to be especially wary of sources who might have some motivation to mislead you. Who are pursuing some sort of vendetta or agenda in which they might try to advance that by convincing you of something that isn't true. But, you know, people come to, we talk to sources who are, feel like they have not getting enough credit in their agencies. They feel like they're slighted. They feel like their bosses are stupid. Sometimes you're right. In this instance, in this era, we are dealing with many, many sources who are deeply concerned about what they are witnessing, what is happening in the world and in Washington and in their agencies. And they're, you know, and so, I mean, you're seeing a deluge of leaking from the White House in particular. I mean, I can't recall ever seeing an administration like this that just sort of the leaks come constantly in all directions. There is, and it sort of reflects in many ways Trump himself, right? He does, his loyalties are to himself, possibly to a couple people in his close members of his family, but everybody else is disposable to him. And so there, that sort of breeds this environment. We have to then deal with these sources for their facts and check those facts against other sources, other ways of verification and corroboration before we use any of them. And, you know, if you can let me go on 1 minute longer, I can give you kind of a terrific example.
Please.
That I write about in the book. So early in the Trump transition, after the election, my colleague, Ellen Nakashima, who covers cybersecurity, goes down to her mailbox at the Post, and there's an envelope in there with no return address. She brings it back up to her desk, which is right across from mine, opens it up, and it's a letter. It's a letter from somebody purporting to be inside the Trump transition team working in Trump Tower, deeply troubled by what this person is seeing happen, particularly in terms of relationships with and in conversations with Russians. We, to this day, still don't know who wrote this letter. It was an extraordinary sort of map for us for stories, a tip sheet. It guided us in the areas to look into. But in no way was that document considered sort of source material for us. We never published any stories based on what its author said because we don't know who that is. We can't tell whether this person is this fabricated. We can only sort of explore these reporting paths that this person outlines. And many of them were terrific. I mean, one of them was, look, Jared Kushner is pursuing ways to set up some sort of back-channel communication with the Russian government. That ended up being absolutely true. And I'm convinced that this person was an insider in the Trump transition. Nevertheless, it was useless, that document, in terms of as a source.
So this was a case of a source that was anonymous in two ways, not just to the readers, but to you as
yeah.
well, and that placed this in a very different category.
Yeah, I mean, we as news organizations rely on anonymous sources, but as you said, they're not anonymous to us. When they're anonymous to us, that requires a whole another level of caution before using anything you get from that source.
Right. One last question of this vent, and then I want to delve
uh-huh.
into the book. I think sometimes when just an ordinary American thinks about a journalist meeting with kind of a special source who is anonymous, to some extent shrouded in secrecy or in the shadows, but offering something very important. I think a lot of people's memories go back to Bob Woodward and to All the President's Men and Hal Holbrook in a dark parking garage speaking literally out of the shadows. And in that particular case, speaking in a way that was always wrapped in enigmas, I mean, mm-hmm. only in the vaguest sense, sort of trying to point the reporter into certain directions, but in fashion that was often maddening, tantalizing,
yeah.
and so on. And it's funny, as I think I even fall into that trap of kind of thinking about this in that sort of way. And then we read your book and get the sense that isn't really what's going on at all. For whatever reason, that particular source behaved that way. But the impression we get from your book and from your other reporting is that these sources are being quite forthcoming and doing all that they can, in a sense, to help you connect the dots and tell a story clearly. Can you just speak about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. That's an interesting question. And there's, I think there is always a tension between a reporter and his or her sources. I mean, we're always pushing them for more than they are comfortable giving, and probably in many cases than they probably should give, right? And you have to be conscious of that as a reporter. You don't want to abuse that relationship. You don't want to lead your sources into trouble. I mean, that is a core responsibility of journalism, and in particular in this at this moment where our sources are under enormous pressure. I mean, the Justice Department has mounted numerous leak hunts. The president has talked about putting reporters in jail, and not to mention sources. And so, I mean, it's our obligation as journalists to look out for their interests as well. Weirdly, you know, you talk about those scenes in All the President's Men, which I've watched a million times. Some things have changed so much since then, and some things haven't. Like, in the middle of these Russia stories, so many of us here in the Post newsroom were downloading and starting to use encrypted communications applications on our phones and things like that to try to do a better job of safeguarding our sources. But in the end, you know, the safest means of interacting with the stores is still meeting face-to-face in some secure location, in some spot where you're not putting stuff on, typing stuff into a phone, into a computer, speaking into a device that somebody else could conceivably intercept. So, I mean, weirdly, those conversations, I didn't really have any conversations. I can't say that I had any conversations in a parking garage, but I write in the book about, you know, using mundane business transactions, for instance, as a cover for conversations with sources.
We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Greg Miller from The Washington Post, and we are talking about his explosive new book called The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. I almost made this my first question. I decided just to wait because I am confessing some real stupidity on my part. When I first heard of your book, its title made absolutely no sense to me.
And
really and truly, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I guess I'm not embarrassed to say that I have never watched an entire episode of the TV program The Apprentice. It has nothing to do with what my feelings might be about Donald Trump himself, but that kind of television interests me not in the least, so I've only seen the briefest little snippet. So that just didn't occur to me. That title, The Apprentice, just isn't at the forefront of my mind. So I completely missed that connection until I actually started reading your book. But of course, the title of your book speaks to much more than just the title of that reality show that helped propel Donald Trump to kind of a different level of fame. But you actually speak of two very important respects in which you think Donald Trump, our current president, can be thought of as an apprentice. Outline for our listeners those two ways in which he is, in a sense, an apprentice.
Sure. I mean, I love the title of the book. I wish I could claim credit for it. My editor at HarperCollins proposed that title, and we've been kicking around some other ideas that were really clunky, like active measures and stuff like this. When I heard this idea, I was like, that's it. It's just beautiful. And I'm like you. I had never really watched his reality show called The Apprentice, but I was aware of it. I knew that that was what it was called. And then when it came across, I immediately just sort of saw the other levels on which that title would work. And there are two ways, and I sort of write about this in the prologue to the book. I mean, Trump arrives as president as an apprentice in many ways, right? He's unschooled in the requirements for this office or any aspect of government service. He's never seen a classified document in his life, never held public office. His interactions with government have mostly been adversarial in his life to that point, lawsuits with the Justice Department and things like that. So he's utterly unprepared for much of what the presidency requires, and he needs extensive help from those around him. And then there's this other aspect of the word, the apprentice, which is it implies kind of a subservience. When you apprentice to somebody, they are your master. And that's, to me, descriptive in many ways of his relationship with Vladimir Putin, which is the fundamental mystery that I try to examine in this throughout this book from beginning to end. That's the theme, that's the idea that holds everything together. So why does he do this? Why does he treat Putin as somebody he admires and sort of emulates? And I think you could argue often he seems to be Putin's apprentice in how he goes about his job. Hmm.
The book begins in its prologue with one of President-elect Donald Trump's very first public appearances. And you spend a great deal of time, actually, laying the groundwork for this. I mean, setting the stage, the backstory, if you will, and describing what occurred down to the most minute detail. It's really quite fascinating. It's absolutely engrossing. But obviously, this is here for a point. In other words, this is of tremendous significance for the story that is to follow. Explain to our listeners what they will read about in this prologue and why you take the time to describe this scene as meticulously as you do.
Absolutely, sure. That's a good question, Greg. So it's partly, as you say, this is the prologue is set at CIA headquarters. On Trump's second day in office. And I really want your listeners to understand that this book isn't just a sort of political screed. This is not me just riffing on news of the day or things like that. I mean, this is, what I was trying to do with this story was take moments that we already may have known about, but develop them and to help people understand their significance, but also to make it super compelling reading. I wanted people to read this and feel like it was almost a novel or a screenplay, that they could see these events unfolding before their eyes. And so I really wanted to describe what happened on his second day in office at the CIA, because I think it just was so symbolic on so many levels. I mean, the investigations into Trump's connections with Russia, the point of origin for all that is something called Russia House. It's on one of the upper floors of the headquarters building at CIA, and it's this space that it's behind a locked steel door. I sort of opened the book with saying, you know, there's these rows of cubicles hidden behind this metal door, and then deeper into Russia House, which is the agency's department for all Russian intelligence operations, is this conference room where they have old Soviet kind of Stalin-era posters around the room. That's where these really troubling conversations start in the middle of 2016. What is happening? What in the hell is happening in this election? What is Russia up to? And it's just literally four or five floors below that, where Trump gives his speech at CIA headquarters. He is standing in that same building, four or five floors below that Russia House operation when he addresses the workforce at the agency. The other important detail is that where the CIA puts him for this speech is it what it's called the memorial wall. So when you go into CIA headquarters and walk into the lobby, on the right-hand side is a wall with a bunch of hand-carved stars, all neatly arrayed in rows. Each of those stars corresponds to somebody from the CIA who's died in the line of duty, including three stars that had been chiseled into the wall just months before Trump got there. So these are people who have died, sacrificed their lives to the agency's mission. It's like, you know, Arlington Cemetery in miniature for the CIA. They put the stage there for Trump and his remarks because it is a sort of dramatic backdrop, and other presidents have delivered speeches there. But there's a sort of responsibility that comes from appearing in that specific location. And Trump seems oblivious to this. So they put the stage up. They bring hundreds of CIA employees in for the weekend to listen to his speech. And rather than talking about the agency or its mission or how important their work is around the world and stopping terrorist plots and so forth, Trump launches into a self-aggrandizing kind of diatribe. He's talking about the crowds that turned out for him in the election, how badly he beat Hillary Clinton, how many Time magazine covers he's been on, the size of the inaugural crowd the day before, and how the press had lied and refused to give him full credit for the millions of people that turned out to see him. And people's jaws are dropping. Here he is standing in front of these stars. People literally represent deaths of anonymous U.S. intelligence operatives, and he's making no mention of them. He's talking only about himself.
And, you know, it's interesting. You quote several people who were there listening to the speech. I mean, people from the CIA, and some of them phrase their displeasure very, very strongly with adjectives like narcissistic and deplorable and despicable. But in some ways, the comment that jumps out at me most is the first quote. You say a CIA veteran called Trump's address one of the most disconcerting speeches I've seen. And I think that word disconcerting is perfectly apt to describe what had to be going through the minds of so many people gathered there.
Yeah. And it was so disconcerting. It was disconcerting even to people who weren't there and who watched it, the coverage of it. You know, this happens on a weekend. Trump, you know, after the speech, he gets back in his car and goes back to the White House, and the agency empties out. But when the work resumes on Monday, something happens, and I write about this at the end of the prologue, that agency people had never, ever seen in any other circumstance. There were people who were arriving for work bringing flowers that they then laid at the base of that memorial wall. They thought that his performance there had so desecrated that location that they somehow just wanted to, I don't know, and they just felt compelled to mark it and try to reconsecrate it in some way. And I just thought that was just sort of the ultimate image of, it tells you so much about the tension between Trump and these institutions, and his disdain for them and their deep concern about his leadership.
Right. And I can't find it now, but I'm pretty sure that in one of your concluding assessments of this speech, you actually call it an amazingly honest and open speech, in the sense that it perfectly and clearly conveys how President Donald Trump will communicate and how he will lead. I mean, we learned a tremendous amount about what kind of leader he would be and remains from that speech alone and the choices that he made in it.
I fully believe that he could deliver that same speech now, right? And people often ask, well, has he grown into the office in any way? Has he smoothed over these edges? Can't you attribute some of this to just his inexperience and his not being familiar with the expectations of being in a setting like that? But I'm convinced that if Trump were to go to CIA tomorrow, he could deliver, he's perfectly capable of delivering a speech that would be almost verbatim identical, right? Every day he reminds us that he is thinking of himself and his own in his own concerns, above all. His tweets, his references, he's so self-referential in all of his speeches and so forth. It's hard for him to empathize with others. It's hard for him to connect to people beyond himself. Mm.
And yet, as you also point out, some of these aspects are what make him so appealing. Maybe not the self-absorption, although the fact that he is such a tireless champion of himself is one thing that probably adds to his charisma as far as those are concerned. But maybe more importantly, just the unscripted nature of so much of what he says. There are Americans, and plenty of them, who find that very refreshing and even needed in our current political landscape.
Absolutely. And you saw that in the election when he was just mowing down the Republican opposition, whose messages were so kind of shaped by focus groups and so stilted. You saw how inauthentic Jeb Bush, despite all of his experience, often seemed when he was standing next to Donald Trump. And Trump is just sort of speaking off the cuff, riffing. And so much of what he says is objectionable, but you can't argue that it doesn't come directly from him. It's not coming through a bunch of political consultants who have devised a message through, you know, endless focus group shop work. It's authentic. It's often offensive, and those two things resonate with people, especially because of the deep anger, resentment toward Washington in general. Right, his attacks on these institutions sort of make people feel like he's somebody who's taking on the establishment that they so despise.
Right. Well, and the fact that he is fearless when it comes to, for instance, offending many, many people. I mean, surely he is aware of the fact, the reality that much of what he says will be enthusiastically received by his own followers, but will cause enormous consternation and offense to many, many others. And while many politicians, in fact, the vast majority of politicians, at least used to be very careful about not doing that, about treading carefully in a way that can come off as so artificial and inauthentic, President Trump boldly speaks his mind in a way that many, many people welcome.
It's a strength and a huge weakness for him simultaneously. I mean, yeah, it makes him seem authentic, but he's really also incapable of doing things that even would even be politically advantageous for him, right? So he can't say anything nice about John McCain, even after McCain's death. The White House puts together a statement they want him to release, and he refuses. He just can't do something that he doesn't believe in, and his anger or resentments or his conflicts with people exceed all other considerations for him. And I write about, you know, the book sort of carries us through his summit with Putin in Helsinki, and that was something I saw firsthand because I was in that room at the palace where he and Putin gave their press conference. And there was that's a moment that Trump really squanders, I sort of thought, right? He's prompted by a question by a reporter in the crowd, can you turn to the Russian leader here and tell him that you believe U.S. intelligence agencies, you believe that Russia did interfere, and that you will not allow Russia to get away with this in the future? He can't do it. He can't do it. If he could have said those words in that moment, we might be looking at his presidency differently. History might regard him differently, but he's incapable of doing it, psychologically incapable.
Right. And you describe that moment in Helsinki as a moment that, for President Trump, in your eyes, began very well and then
yes.
took this turn that you regard as, to some extent, maybe even self-destructive to an extent.
Yeah, he's often self-destructive. I mean, the book is full of cases of his sort of self-destructive impulses and the consequences of them, including his decision to fire Comey. I mean, his inability to see around corners is astonishing for somebody who's, you know, his whole brand is about kind of understanding the leverage of situations and manipulating and maneuvering around other people. He fails that test over and over as president. I mean, he decides to fire Comey. He decides to hang that decision on the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, without it occurring, and believes that his problems are solved, right? He has a meeting with the Russian foreign minister in the Oval Office the very next day and says, I fired this guy. Our troubles are over. I have a lot more freedom now to work with you guys. No problem. Doesn't see what's coming. Doesn't see that sort of victimizing a deputy attorney general might have adverse consequences. Then Rosenstein gets his revenge, right? He appoints Mueller. So at one point, he had FBI Director Jim Comey leading this investigation, charge of the Russia probe, somebody he can meet with, somebody he can interact with, somebody who's got a million other things on his plate, fires him, thinks the problem's over. Now he's got special counsel Robert Mueller, who's the most, I think, almost a frighteningly focused law enforcement figure, right? I mean, he has just sort of been stalking Trump ever since.
We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Greg Miller from The Washington Post, talking about his new book, The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. I do want us to explore a couple of specific things in this book, which is sprawling and thorough. The first chapter is called The Hack, and it opens the first section of the book, and this is where we talk about the hacking into the computer files of the Democratic National Committee. As you lay this out, one of the most interesting aspects of the story is about what the Democratic National Committee does when they discover that something has happened and that someone has gained access to a large number of very sensitive emails. Describe to our listeners what their response to this was and the inadvertent harm they were bringing down upon themselves by reacting to this as they did.
Yeah, this is just one of those. This is one of those parts of the story where you, I think, you just sort of, you know how you're in movies sometimes and you see a villain approaching and you just sort of want to scream at the main character to turn around, right? I mean, this is just like that.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Right. It's a foreign intelligence service that's the first to sort of detect that this Russian hacking operation is rooting around inside the DNC. And they call this the attention of the U.S. government. We have a lot of allies. They let us know. Goes to the FBI. It's the FBI's job to follow up. So the FBI calls the DNC to tell them, look, we have some reason to think that there's some hacking. There's a hacking operation targeting your servers. They get routed to the help desk. I mean, here's the FBI calling with a huge computer problem, a huge threat, and they call the front desk and pass this call over to the help desk. And then what unfolds takes months. It takes months for these DNC computer security people to even believe that this is really the FBI calling them. They think it's just some prankster. They refuse to go along with it. They don't believe it until they have a face-to-face meeting and the guy shows his badge to them. And then the FBI just sort of plods along trying to get the attention of these computer security people at the DNC, never bothers to knock on the door, never walks over to knock on the door and say, I need to talk to the director, I need to talk to the leadership here, we've got a problem. So it's this huge disconnect, and it's such an enormous missed opportunity. So much might have played out differently had the FBI handled it better, had the DNC handled it better. Nobody understood what was happening until it was too late.
Right. Another point you make that I think is almost as important is the fact that once the Democratic National Committee at the highest levels did learn and believed that this had occurred, that information was not disseminated. And so you had a period of at least weeks, and maybe it was even months, where emails continued to be freely exchanged with nobody being, in a sense, on guard, being more cautious about what they were putting into emails. And that only worsened what the ultimate problem would be when so many sensitive and deeply embarrassing emails were finally released to the public.
Yeah, I mean, they're just so... So many issues and decisions that you can sort of wring your hands about throughout this whole process. And so, yeah, even after DNC leadership finally becomes aware of and convinced that they have a problem, they still can't bring themselves to just sort of act severely right away. Let's close down this network. Let's clean it before there's any more damage done. They have real worries, right? They have other things going on. They don't believe they can afford to do that. The convention is right around the corner. They're dealing with the fight within their party between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And so they're trying to plan the cleanup and of their security problem around all of these other sort of political imperatives of the middle of a presidential campaign. And so you're right. That just gives the Russians more time inside that network to keep piling up damaging emails that they later dump on WikiLeaks.
Right. And so, in a sense, the Democratic National Committee is foolish in several different ways. I mean, so foolish, first of all, to do what they did in terms of what was going on behind the scenes in terms of favoring Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, and then writing about it in an email, and then being so sloppy when information finally comes out that there is access to these emails and so on. It's foolishness upon foolishness that is really their fault. I mean, for all that this Russian hack, I mean, did in terms of revealing it, they shoulder so much of the blame here.
Yeah, and I think you're touching on a theme there that's much, much broader in some ways, Greg. That's true really, so what Russia ends up exploiting are their own divisions inside the DNC, right? They didn't make those emails. The Russians stole them, publicized them, but they didn't alter them. And similarly, the Russian propaganda campaign didn't create new divisions in our society. They were just preying on and taking advantage of existing divisions. So much of the content that they pumped into Facebook, much of it false, phony front stuff, was nevertheless just exacerbating, you know, these deep fissures politically in our country right now.
Right.
And, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, and you can just sort of go on and on, the immigration, the xenophobic impulses of the alt-right, things like this just over and over again. It's us as much as anybody who is to blame for what happened in 2016.
I want to make sure to highlight a really important point from Chapter 8, in which you spell out much of what the Russians are believed to have done via social media, and particularly Facebook. And this is a exceptionally fascinating chapter. You make a point that had never occurred to me, and that is about how America had an especially high vulnerability to this. Perhaps we were more vulnerable than any other country on the face of the planet might have been. You write at one point, all of these social media companies were American, part of a massively profitable, fast-growing technology industry that was central to the economic might of the United States and at least potentially its geopolitical soft power. The global reach of the company's platforms carried images of America and its influence to every corner of the globe. U.S. intelligence officials for years had exploited the home court advantage of having so much world communications traffic flow through American technology by vacuuming up massive volumes of online data flowing to and from American internet companies. But the United States' dominance in technology also created, incongruously, an asymmetric vulnerability that a country like Russia could exploit. Help us understand what the nature of our vulnerability was. And it is a vulnerability that I assume is still very much in place.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, this is just, there are so many ways in which Russia kind of exploited perceived strengths in the American system and turned them against us. And the access to Facebook and Twitter is just so critical to the effectiveness and the impact of this Russia campaign. It's inconceivable, you know, it's really inconceivable that Russia could have done something like this in a previous era, in the Soviet era, in the 1980s or the 1990s. In the United States, we have these companies. Silicon Valley is a sort of global leader in technology and social media and so forth. And it is so pervasive in the United States. There are so many of us are connected to Facebook and Twitter and so forth and so dependent on it that when somebody figures out how to run messages that are counter to our interests across those networks, we're powerless to stop it, at least not in real time. It takes a long – we're slow to recognize the vulnerability of these platforms. So, you know, I often get asked kind of, well – so what? So Russian trolls put a bunch of weird ads on Facebook and on Twitter and so forth. Proved to me that it altered a single vote. But the math becomes overwhelming at some point. We now know that more than 100 million Americans were exposed to Russian propaganda, much of it denigrating Hillary Clinton, talking about her allegedly dire health circumstances. Much of it propping up Donald Trump. It's 100 million Americans. It's almost as many who voted in the 2016 race. And this is a contest that comes down to just 80,000 votes. There's no way that you could turn the tables on Russia because of the controls that its society has on social media platforms like this. America's freedom, its openness, leaves us vulnerable. I mean, it's a huge strength for us, but in this case, it was a huge vulnerability.
I think one thing that people say is that this kind of disinformation can flow from anybody, including American entities. Do we even understand kind of the proportion of how much of this, in a sense, kind of propaganda was being circulated from specifically Russian sources versus from people here in America championing the cause of Donald Trump?
It's really hard to disentangle all of that. I mean, you're right. I mean, we end up focusing a lot on Russia and this troll factory in St. Petersburg where hundreds of people would show up for work every day just to put on phony online personas and start pumping crazy conspiracy theory kind of content and blasting it out at us day after day after day. But there are entities inside the United States that do that every day as well. And, you know, which one do you listen to? Which one do you accidentally click on? You may never even really know.
Ultimately, of course, this story is about even more than all that we have talked about. And you are very careful to not make any kind of pronouncements about where all of this is headed. It seems to me that one of the most complicated challenges in understanding all of this is the fact that we are sometimes talking about things people do that are wrong. There's something wrong about lying to a reporter, but there's nothing illegal about lying to a reporter or other practices that are dishonest or deceitful or self-serving or selfish or whatever, but that does not cross the line into illegality, let alone when impeachable offenses. As we move on from here into whatever this next chapter is going to ultimately mean for President Trump and for our country, how would you have us think about all that is surrounding us? What is most important to keep in mind as we go on from here?
You know, I think that's a great question. I think the bigger question for me is, and it's one we can't really answer now, and we might not really have a full understanding of for many years, is to what extent is this a point of departure for our country, what we're going through right now? You were just talking about something that's really interesting. It's this idea that these things that seem like they should be illegal but aren't necessarily illegal, or norms that we thought were codified somehow, written down somewhere, required of people, but really aren't. They're just expectations that have come up through tradition developed over many, many years. We just expect our presidential candidates to release their tax returns. There's nothing forcing them to do it. We expect our politicians to at least pretend or try to be truthful with us. And when caught in a lie, to be ashamed about it, to be embarrassed, humiliated, for there to be consequences and political sanctions that they face. Trump has turned all of that upside down, right? I mean, he lies in others' falsehoods at an astonishing rate, with seemingly no consequence. These are just sort of tell us of things, sort of vulnerabilities in our system and our way of doing things that we may not have ever really confronted before. And so, I mean, going forward, obviously I'm hugely interested in trying to learn more about what does Mueller have? What does Mueller end up doing? What does that mean for Trump? Do we end up in impeachment? But there are bigger questions for our country. I mean, do we ever recover what we used to think of as this equilibrium? Do we ever recover to the institutions that are being damaged day after day after day, with Trump calling the press, you know, which where I make my money and devote my career, the enemy of the people, fake news, discrediting the FBI, where Trump has had plenty of help from Devin Nunes and other congressional leaders. Accusing the FBI of being basically a political sort of operation and doing the work of Hillary Clinton. I mean, we can't really function as a democracy, or at least not function as the democracy we've come to think of as American, if we don't have trust in these really core institutions of democracy. And I guess I'm just not sure yet how much damage these things can sustain but somehow survive and bounce back.
The book, again, is The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy, published by Custom House, the author, Greg Miller. Greg Miller, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book, and thank you for being so generous with your time. It's been a privilege for me to speak with you today on The Morning Show.
So happy to do it. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, the author of a fascinating book called The Tango War, which explores the way in which